Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the organizers very much for the invitation to be here to share with you some of our ongoing research looking at climate change impacts on the Arctic critical zones. So I'm a molecular microbial ecologist, one of the few in this group, I think. During my training, I started getting really interested in thinking about how to link the very small scale measurements that I was making up to ecosystem scale properties. And this led me about 5 years ago to team up with an ecosystem ecologist, Scott Seleska, at University of Arizona. And in our early conversation, he introduced me to his idea of the Willie Sutton site selection principle in global change biology. And for those of you who may have heard of this man, Willie Sutton was a bank robber early in the last century. And he was a very, very famous bank robber, very much captured the popular attention. And when they finally caught him, the reporters were crowding around him and they said, Willie, why do you do it? Why do you rob all these banks? And he just looked and he said, because that's where the money is. And so on the same principle, if you look at this soil carbon map here, the global soil carbon map here, that you've seen several times today, it's clear that there's a couple places where there's a lot of soil carbon concentrated, and that's in the poles and in the tropics. And so we're actually interested in the polar regions, and about a third to a half of the planet's soil organic carbon is stored in these northern soils. Dr. Ratan Lal highlighted this for us this morning, and it's been brought up several times since then. And this really highlights another problem, which is what Scott refers to as the big biology problem in climate science, which is that even if you know exactly how much fossil fuel is going to be burned, which of course we don't, we still won't know how climate will change because it's an ecosystem effect, right? It's the net processes of all the plants, animals, soils, microbiota that lead to feedbacks. And of course, that's why we're all here, because we're interested in those feedbacks today, particularly with respect to soils. So these relationships are still mostly a black box. And so another way to phrase this, go to where this carbon is go to where the major consequential unknowns are in climate science. And in this case, that's really carbon soil stocks. Okay, so these high carbon soils also overlap with the permafrost soils shown here in this global soil taxonomy map as the pale aqua region. Okay. Permafrost soils cover about a quarter of the terrestrial land surface, and as has been highlighted, they store this extraordinary amount of carbon. And this carbon has been frozen, locked up in a relatively non-bioavailable form for hundreds to thousands of years. Okay. And as many of you are familiar with, under global warming projections and initial observations, the warming that we're experiencing on the planet is happening disproportionately at the poles. And so mid-range IPCC projections have the poles warming by 7 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Okay. And that means permafrost is thawing and rapidly. Okay. This is a particularly dramatic example of what can happen. This was something that Margaret Torn highlighted in her talk earlier, which is that you can actually see in habitats like this, in soils like this, you can see landscape scale changes very quickly because the permafrost is supporting the land, and so as it thaws, the land collapses. Okay. So there's a person in there for scale. I'm sorry, I've got a cold right now, so I'm a little stuffy, hoarse. So what you can see in the lower right corner is the projected decreases in permafrost area on the y-axis over time on the x-axis. And as Dr. Torn highlighted earlier, we're really on this red trajectory, the RCP 8.5 trajectory. Okay, so we're looking at the loss of half to all of permafrost by the end of the century. Okay, so what's the consequence of this thaw? Well, that thawing permafrost carbon is now available to become a feast for microbes. So it's like you've had a freezer full of juicy carbon, and now the freezer's failing. Okay, so this can represent, and this is why people are so worried, a large loss of carbon to the atmosphere. Let's see how this works. There's a question of what kind of carbon gas it will be emitted as. And this really depends critically on local geohydrology, which, talking to my friends who think really about landscape scale structures, is not very well constrained for permafrost across the planet as a whole. Okay, so depending on local geohydrology, some portion of thawing permafrost becomes wetlands. Okay. Now, wetlands are the largest natural source of methane. They produce about 90% currently of natural methane. And methane, as most of you probably are familiar with, is a very potent greenhouse gas. It's about 33 times as potent as CO2 at the 100-year time horizon. Now, the methane that's being produced from thawing permafrost, that carbon can come from two places. As permafrost thaws, plant productivity typically increases, and so you can have new carbon, that is newly fixed carbon, fueling methane emissions. Or you can have the old carbon, the carbon that was formerly locked up in the permafrost, now fueling methane emissions. And this is a little bit of a situation where you have bad versus worse, because if it's new carbon, you've now effectively exchanged a molecule of an atom of carbon in the atmosphere that was in the form of CO2 and made it 33 times more powerful. Versus if you've taken old carbon that might have been locked up out of the atmosphere for hundreds to thousands of years, and now you've put it out in a particularly powerful form. Okay, so to summarize, permafrost thaw can lead to methane, which is potentially a large positive feedback to warming. And the IPCC, in its most recent report, has continued to highlight this as a critical unknown, which is that the release of carbon as CO2 or methane from permafrost is potentially going to be quite large, and few studies really partition the ratio of CO2 to methane that will be released. Okay, so if you're interested in studying methane cycling in these sorts of systems, you really need to understand the microbes, because the microbes are the ones mediating it. So, sorry, the blue doesn't show up great on the dark brown, but let's walk through the key processes. So we've got thawing permafrost contributing old carbon to active soil organic matter. You have new carbon from elevated plant growth under permafrost thaw, contributing new carbon to soil organic matter. The relative percent contribution of those varies depending on the situation and the habitat. Okay, now microbial decomposition and fermentation of that soil organic matter lead to a number of products, including acetate, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen. And acetoclastic methanogenesis takes methane and takes acetate and produces methane. But you can also have methane produced by this other pathway, carbon dioxide and H2, which is called CO2 reductive, sometimes also called hydrogenotrophic methanogenesis. So the relative contributions of those two processes depend a lot on the particular habitat conditions. Okay, and then generally under aerobic, we've now discovered it also occurs under anaerobic conditions in certain places, you can have oxidation of that methane back to CO2. And then, of course, these greenhouse gases are lost to the atmosphere in changing ratios depending on the situation. And really, when we measure using our eddy flux towers or our auto chambers, when we measure the releases of those gases into the atmosphere, we're really seeing the integrated sum of all of these processes happening below ground. Okay, so is it okay to treat this as a black box? Or is it actually matter that this is performed by a complex consortium of microbes? This is an open question. I'd also like to highlight for you at this point that these two pathways for producing methane have different characteristic signatures in the methane that they produce because they fractionate C13 and C12 differentially. Okay, so that'll become important later on. You can tell them apart based on the signature in the methane. Okay, so in this context of microbial carbon cycling and thawing permafrost, two questions really motivated Scott and my work. And these kind of represent the two grand challenges in our respective fields. So on the biogeochemical side, it is this critical open question about how climate change is impacting carbon cycling in this climate critical system, and you can see how it's impacting our boardwalk and our field site here. And on the microbial ecology side, some of you might have heard this genes to ecosystems paradigm, and yet how we actually do this, despite the fact that the phrase is a cliche, how we actually do this has remained rather elusive. And so one of the goals of this project really has been to sort of nail that, to dive into that a little bit more deeply. And we're trying to do this in two ways. At sort of the local level, thinking about measurements, to gene scale to fluxes. So if we match up biogeochemical data and molecular data, do we see a strong relationship? And the other way is at a larger scale, like the ecosystem scale, thinking about modeling. Okay? And if you treat microbes as a black box versus if you actually explicitly characterize individual microbial functional groups or lineages, does that actually get you any improvement in accuracy? So To address these motivating questions, we assembled this international interdisciplinary team spanning microbial ecologists. I'd like to highlight here my fellow microbial ecologist on this project, Dr. Dean Tyson, the Australian Institute for Marine, Australian Centre for Ecogenomics. And we have a range of biogeochemists and modelers as well from a range of institutions. Okay, and with this team, we developed a project examining carbon transformations and thawing permafrost in subarctic Sweden. And we received funding for this from the Department of Energy starting in 2010. And recently, we expanded the team of folks involved to cover more disciplines, including viral ecology, which is very exciting as a microbiologist. OK, so our field site for looking at this is Stordalen Meyer. And it's a really great long-term field site. Okay. So there's been a field station there for over 100 years, remarkably. We really don't have anything like that with that kind of longevity and ease of access on this continent. And this is adjacent to Stordalen Meyer. Stordalen Meyer was one of the sites of some of the first international polar year investigations and some of the very first field measurements of methane emissions in the 70s. So the Meyer's been intensively studied for some time. There's also extensive in-place instrumentation, which is great for piggybacking on top of if you're a microbiologist who wants to make links to larger scale processes. So this includes eddy flux towers, auto chamber systems, and inline carbon gas flux analyzers. And actually, under Scott's leadership, we've significantly updated these so that we can actually get high resolution isoflux measurements for methane and CO2. And by that I mean every 3 hours we're getting CO2 and methane, both fluxes and isotopic compositions, which is a very powerful data set on the biogeochemistry side. So this site contains three distinct habitat types. We have the dry permafrost pulses. Okay. The dotted line here represents the active layer. And so the active layer, as you've heard from several different talks, but I know people are coming in and out, is the depth of the soil column that thaws seasonally. And permafrost is defined as anything that stays frozen for 2 or more years. Okay, so below that is permafrost. Once you have some permafrost thaw, the landscape starts to collapse. Okay, so you actually have physical slumping. Then you have this dynamic habitat where you have a perched water table that migrates up and down. Okay. And that defines an oxic and an anoxic zone within the water column. And this is really dominated by sphagnum mosses. And so it's quite acidic on the range of 4, 4.2, up to 5. When you have full thaw of the permafrost, the ground slumps further. And that creates, you move from a bog to a fen. And this is a sedge-dominated fen, a particular species called Areophryum. And here, the groundwater table, because you've had so much vertical slumpage, is now at or above the surface. Okay, and this really represents a global change succession. If you look at the annual carbon fluxes, I mentioned that when permafrost thaws, it can support increased plant productivity. And that's what is indicated here by the CO2. You go from a situation where you have the pulses being a source of CO2 to those fens really being a robust sink for CO2. But if you look at the total hydrocarbons, the vast majority of which are methane, you actually see the opposite trend, of course, because these are becoming anoxic environments, okay? And so if you look at the endpoint habitat, you have sort of carbon neutrality, but because that methane packs such a wallop, you can translate it into CO2 equivalents using that 33 conversion factor to really get an overall picture of what's going on here in terms of the global warming potential per meter squared change of going from pulsa permafrost to fully thawed fen. You get about a 7-fold increase. So this is a really significant impact on radiative forcing per meter squared of habitat. Okay, so at this site, in this context, we wanted to take a systems approach with this great team to characterizing this subarctic critical zone. So we have these great auto chambers. We're getting the high-resolution fluxes and isotopes from the fancy quantum cascade lasers that Scott helped design in the postdoc. And then we're taking cores throughout the growing season adjacent to, but not too close, to the auto chambers. We've got replicates. Okay, and then we subsample those with depth. We look at pore and bulk geochemistry to give us information about methane production potential, gross versus net production, and old and new carbon. And then this is where our side of things comes in, the microbiological side. We do biomolecule extractions. We extract the DNA. We use the 16S fingerprint gene to characterize the microbial community composition. And then we also sequence the DNA overall to give us insights into the metabolic potential of these communities. Okay. We also extract RNA and protein and sequence those in order to give complementary views into the expressed metabolism. Because just like every single cell in your body has the same DNA, but is performing very different functions, so too different cells in a microbial community can have the same DNA, but be doing very different metabolic activities, which is important if you're trying to understand what's happening with carbon transformations in these soils. Okay, so this is a type of diagram you've now seen several times, which is fantastic. Makes it easier. So there's a lot of different metrics that our geochemical colleagues and partners on this have used to show that at this site, SAW is increasing soil organic matter lability. And this is one particular example. So this is this FTICRMS. This is a Van Creveland diagram that you've seen several times now. This is the hydrogen to carbon ratio on the y-axis, the oxygen to carbon ratio on the x-axis. And these are the habitat distinct formulas shown, not all of them. Okay? The green represents the partially thawed site, that moss-dominated bog. And the magenta represents the fully thawed, sedge-dominated fen. So what you can see is that really the soil organic matter composition is quite different, as you might imagine, moving from a bog to a fen. And overall, what this translates to is lower organic oxygen content. You can see you're moving from along this way on the x-axis. Okay, you have decreasing lignin and tannin-like compounds. You have lower aromaticity as you move from bog to fen. You have increasing proteins and fatty acid-like compounds. And you have more microbially produced compounds. So collectively, this is one particular example, again, that's echoed with a lot of different types of data from the site, showing that organic matter lability is increasing. So this organic matter is fueling a microbial community that is also, as you might imagine, changing across the SAW. So this is a complex diagram, but don't worry, I'm going to walk you through it, all right? So we have the different, each column here represents a different sample, and they're grouped into Pulsa, Sphagnum, and Areophorum, which recall represent this permafrost thaw gradient. Okay, so we can divide these columns into the three groups. Okay, we can also subdivide the sphagnum based on that perched water table that migrates up and down. So we have the oxic portion of the bog and the anoxic portion of the bog. Now each of these rows represents a different microbial taxa. Okay, and these are the 1,000 most abundant taxa collectively at this site. Okay, so once you have this information, you can start to tunnel in what's going on with the microbiota by, for example, parsing them out into functional groups. So in the case of methanogens, that's actually relatively easy because all of the methanogens are pretty closely related, so we can say what they are relatively easily. Okay, so that's the methanogens up here, and you can see that, as fits our worldview, they're not present in the aerobic habitats, and they are present in the anaerobic habitats. Okay. And remember, this is just microbial community composition. We're not looking at activity yet. For the methanotrophs, it's a little bit more tricky. I can't just point to one of these bars here because they're phylogenetically distributed. So there's a lot of different lineages that can perform methane oxidation. Okay. So SAW changes organic matter lability by many metrics. SAW changes microbial community composition, but there's high patchiness. Okay, within each site. And SAW increases methane fluxes, but with high temporal variability. And this is something that this nice laser lets us see really well. So in the blue, again, the color coding is staying the same. So the blue is the fully thawed, wettest site. The green is the bog. Okay, and the brown is the Pulsa permafrost. Okay, so you can see that permafrost draw is driving this overall quite large increase in methane emissions, but with very high variability. This relates to what we see with the microbial community. As you saw on the last slide, when we pointed out that the methanogens are really only showing up in the anoxic environments, Carrie, a postdoc in Scott's lab, did pie charts to show that same thing. So purple represents the methanogens. It's critical to note here that the relative abundance of the methanogens doesn't actually scale with the overall methane emissions. Okay, that's going to stand in contrast to something you're going to see in a minute.
Okay. In addition to methane emissions increasing, you actually see that there's a pretty significant shift in their isotopic signature. Remember we said that the C13 signature of the emitted methane tells you something about what process produced it. So on this y-axis here, we have a shift from down by about minus 90, minus 85, up to about minus 55. So delta C13 is a methane. And that's a shift from CO2 reductively produced methane to acetoclastically produced methane. And so what you can see is, this is along the growing season of one specific year here on the x-axis, you see a shift from the bog to the fed, from CO2 reductive to now a contribution of acetoclastic. Okay? And if you look at the microbial communities through the year, now we've taken that purple wedge of the pie that was all the methanogens, and we've broken it up into acetoclastic versus CO2 reductive. And so here, where you've got the bog and you have CO2 reductive signature in the emitted methane, sure enough, you have CO2 reductive methanogens. When you get into methane that's coming out with an acetoclastic partial signature, you see some acetoclasts. So that's great. So far this is all lining up nicely with how we think things should work, and yet has very rarely been demonstrated, this sort of concordance. Okay, so things get increasingly interesting the farther we tunnel into this. So methanogens are not only increasing in abundance, they're also highly active in the thawed habitat. So now if we look at the expressed proteins and we lump them by phylum, the Uriarchaeota, the orange group, is where those methanogens are, and we see that they're comprising quite a large portion of the expressed proteins. And if we slice this instead of by phylogenetic identity, rather by metabolic function, we see that methane metabolism accounts for 22% of that particular community proteome that was examined. Okay, so that's the community portrait overall. What about particular thaw-responsive taxa? So this lineage right here really caught our attention, as you might imagine. It's getting to very high abundances. Our colleagues in Gene Tyson's lab were able to identify who it was. They saw that it was in Thanocell alias, but it was divergent enough that it seemed to be its own unique novel family that had not been described before. Because it was at such high abundance under these thaw conditions, they were able to assemble its genome. Okay. And they saw that not only did it have the genes, but it expressed them at very high levels for hydrogenotrophic metabolism. Hydrogenotrophic methanogenesis, excuse me. And then because we generate these 16S fingerprint libraries for sites all over the world, it's one of the things we like to do as microbial ecologists. Even if we don't know what all the tags are, we like to go out and survey places, and then we deposit the surveys that we've taken into centralized databases. And Ben from Gene's lab went out and looked in these databases, and he said, gosh, this organism is really important at our site, and now we have a genome for it. Let's go back and see where else in the world it occurs. And we saw that it actually occurs all over the world across four continents, spanning 42 publications, in a variety of methane-producing habitats. Okay, so if you think about the percentage of the sevenfold increase that could be due to this organism based on back-of-the-envelope calculations, it's potentially a third of it. Okay, but that's all a little squishy. So let's get to something more concrete. If you do a linear regression of all the different variables you can measure at the site, both of the microbial communities sliced 10 different ways, and the abiotic parameters that we think of as driving carbon emissions, it turns out that the along the x-axis here, the relative percentage of that organism is the best predictor for the fractionation of the methane that's emitted. Okay? So it predicts ecosystem scale isotopic fragmentation ahead of other predictors. So now if you do a stepwise multiple regression, you see that the relative abundance of this organism beats out water table depth. So does this mean microbial ecology matters? One of our, I'm a microbial ecologist, so. Well, but it's actually really controversial, right? Because a lot of people say, you know what, it's cool to study the microbes, but essentially they're slaves to the geochemistry. So at larger scales, it's totally fine to black box model them. And I actually kind of subscribe to that, like I like microbes and I study them, but I kind of wouldn't have been, I was really surprised by this answer. And there's a number of technical caveats in terms of this data that make it even more surprising to me. So this is actually quite interesting because it says that if you really want to understand what the ecosystem is doing, there may be particular keystone lineages that it actually is worth our while to investigate and characterize. Okay, so I'm going to, I'm just going to highlight here that the relative abundance of that organism, which corresponded to the effector fractionation, that gives us a link then to the CH4 to CO2 emissions, which recall the IPCC highlighted as a key unknown. So now we have a link between this organism and a key unknown in climate models. Okay, and I'm going to skip this slide in the interest of time. So the goal overall is the system-level characterization with real predictive value for climate feedbacks. And the way that we're trying to do that, the key step that we're at right now, is relating these beautiful Van Creveland diagrams to our microbial community data to try to draw much more sophisticated linkages than sort of the bulk ones of methane cyclers. Okay, so the pressing research needs for understanding the climate change, as is our mandate in this session. Okay. So there's a number that are related to cryosols that we've already talked about. In terms of thinking about what's going to happen with this permafrost, the key unknowns with the permafrost question, and then generally, does microbial ecology matter, okay, for being able to predict the trajectory of SOM? Soil organic matter, okay? And I really like Margaret Torrance's description of the ISEN, the International Soil Experiment Network, and I just wanted to highlight that along these lines, there's the Global Peat Microbiome Project being led by Eric Liliscoff and Jamie Limit, through the Forest Service, and what they're doing is collecting our microbial data with the help of the Joint Genome Institute from all over the world, from peatlands all over the world, and they're linking it to a variety of both experimental and observational metadata to try to tie this all together. Okay, so I'm excited to talk to Dr. Torn later. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge our funding sources, some extra people who are not co-authors but were involved in the work, and my lab. And thank you so much for your time.